We are at part two of our series from Joshua called Into the Promised Future. If we were watching Into the Promised Future, if that was a TV programme, today's episode would be called Spies and Lies. It would be coming up on the screen, but when we met them last week, in our first episode, we met with them. They were still on the brink of the Promised Land. The Israelites and Joshua were just on this side of it, you know, on the side of the Jordan. Have they gone into the Promised Land? Not yet. Now, quite a lot of TV shows, before you get into them, come up with the previously on. So, this morning, previously on Into the Promised Future. About 40 years previous, so we're going quite a long way back. 40 years ago, the Israelites have left Egypt, they've left Sinai, and got the Ten Commandments, and now they are in the desert of Paran. They are east of the River Jordan. And this is from where Moses sends out the 12, one from each tribe, to find out what the land was like. So they go for 40 days, and they come back. And 10 of them say the land is wonderful, but the people there are really scary. But the other two say the land is wonderful, but they offer their voice of concern, of reason. And they basically tell the people, you know, God's told us this land is ours, we should go. The people seem to have forgotten about all the marvellous things that God has done, like splitting the river and the parting of the Red Sea and the pillars of fire and smoke that lead them in. And all they can hear is how dangerous the people are, how big the people are, how scary it is to do this. They've forgotten their wonderful God. And they cast their minds back with those rose-tinted spectacles about how good life was back in Egypt. Does that resonate? How often do we look at our problems and see them as bigger than our God? And then if things aren't really going our way, or the way we thought they would go, or planned they would go, then we start moaning and complaining. And as Sharon said last week, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. And perhaps we get caught up in thinking that our plans are better than God's plans, or proposing that there's no way he can redeem the situation or that we've got ourselves into, or the actions of others have got us into. So the Israelites are so cross they're about to give Moses the sack and head back to slavery, but Caleb and Joshua get together again and they do the travel agent thing. They do the "it's exceedingly good" about the land. They tell everyone how fantastic it is. And they tell them, remember that these are the people who've wandered in the land for 40 years and have eaten nothing but manna and quail. And they know that their land is going to be full of milk and honey. How attractive would that be if you didn't eat the same thing for 40 years? And they don't just big up the land, they big up God. He will lead us into the land. He will be with us. They remind the people that God was with them and they're not to be scared. But the people are scared. They stay scared. And they kind of want to stone Joshua and Caleb, even when they were just reminding them of God's plans, of what God had promised. And that's what resulted in 10 of them unfortunately dying of a plague, which seems ironic considering what happened to the Egyptians when they were coming out of Egypt. So the 10 died of plague, and everyone who's, I think, is under, you know, none of those who were 20 years old or more when they came to Egypt will see the land I promised. So that's where we're at the moment. We've got Joshua and Caleb who followed God wholeheartedly. Do we follow God wholeheartedly? Are we known for that? Are we known for our complaining and moaning and questioning God? It looks like we have a choice to make. Are we going to follow God with a complete commitment to him and his ways for us? Will we be devoted and dedicated to him no matter what's going on around us? So that's the story so far. That's the previously on. So we just need to come to the text we're looking at this morning, and I've asked Andy to read it for me, otherwise I will just talk for too long and you'll get bored with my voice. So, and he's much better at reading anyway than I am, so if he can come and read Joshua 2 to us.
Actually, I'm going to do the preaching as well, actually, but she doesn't know that. Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. "Go, look over the land," he said, "especially Jericho." So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab, and stayed there. The king of Jericho was told, "Look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land." So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab: "Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they've come to spy out the whole land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know who they were or where they had come from." At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, the men left. "I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them." But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of the flax she had laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. Before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, "I know that the Lord has given this land to you, and that great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts sank, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven, above, and on the earth below. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family, because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and my mother, my brothers and my sisters, and all who belong to them, and you will save us from death." "Our lives for your lives," the men assured her. "If you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us the land." So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. Now she had said to them, "Go to the hills so that the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there 3 days until they return, and then go on your way." The men said to her, "This oath you made us swear will not be binding on us unless we enter the land, and you have tied this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you have brought your father and mother, your brothers and all your family into your house. If anyone goes outside your house into the street, his blood will be on his own head. We will not be responsible. As for anyone who is in the house with you, his blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell what we are doing, we will be released from the oath you made us swear." "Agreed," she replied. "Let it be as you say." So she sent them away, and they departed. And she tied the scarlet cord in the window. When they left, they went into the hills and stayed there 3 days, until the pursuers had searched all along the road and returned without finding them. Then the two men started back. They went down out of the hills, forded the river, and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him everything that had happened to them. Then they said to Joshua, "The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us."
This fighting line now appears on the screen. We are now entering our episode. Joshua secretly sent two spies to go into the land. After knowing how badly it had gone last time, seeing as he was the only two left of the original 12, he still takes a risk and goes for it. Note that this time it's his idea. Nowhere in the text does it say it was God's idea. If you look back at the original, it says God told Moses to send the 12. And also note that Joshua did it secretly. Now, was that because he was a bit worried? Was he perhaps demonstrating outstanding leadership? Was it that he needed to check what had been happening in the Promised Land over the last 40 years? 40 years is a long time. Maybe they'd got more fortified cities, or maybe the people had grown even taller. Maybe the land wasn't quite so good now. Maybe the people of the land had wrecked it. A lot can happen in 40 years. Maybe, just maybe, the power had gone to Joshua's head. Remember, he's just taken over from Moses. And suddenly he's making decisions that were the responsibility of Moses. But it's also possible that Joshua wanted to just be prepared. Maybe 40 years in the desert had challenged his faith too. Maybe he was just having a bit of a wobble. He's in charge of an awful lot of people with an awful lot of responsibility. And maybe his confidence has just got a little bit shaken. Now that can happen to us too. Even if we're not in positions of leadership, we can easily lose confidence in ourselves. Even in situations where we've done perfectly okay before. But perhaps especially in new situations. But God has put Joshua in place, and God puts us into places. And we're to serve him wherever he has put us, with his confidence, even if ours has gone a little bit wobbly. Because the promises of God to Joshua are the same to us. Joshua 1:9, have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. And those are promises that echo throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament, and are embodied in Emmanuel, our God with us, and in the Holy Spirit who remains with us, no matter what we face. So Joshua sends his spies. Now I have to say, on one hand, they were great spies. They were fantastic. We have no idea to this day what their names were or who they were. They were fantastic. That's excellent. Except for one thing, that they cross the River Jordan and within minutes they are noticed, which makes them absolutely rubbish spies. Perhaps they forgot to put on false beards or disguise their voices. Maybe they were so much smaller than everybody else they stuck out like a sore thumb. Either way, they are seen and they are noticed, which makes them absolutely rubbish as spies. Ahem. I do apologise. We are moving into an X-rated part of the episode. But it should be shown after 9 o'clock, because where did they go? They went to a prostitute's house. They went into the land. They didn't just pop in for a brief visit. They went and they stayed there. Now, why do we find them at the house of a prostitute? A prostitute who's known by name, Rahab. Interesting that we don't know the names of the spies, but we know the name of the prostitute. Now, was going to the prostitute's house a ploy to go unnoticed? To do what other foreigners might have done, the usual practice for travellers. Some commentators try to sanitise the events. They say that Rahab was an innkeeper. They say that she was a maid of the house, but if she was an innkeeper, say she was the owner of a tavern, let's just say it was a special kind of room service that went on. So Rahab, according to the text, is a prostitute, and her house is known as a place of ill repute. It is, quite rightly, probably a place of anonymity. It's hardly the place that you would want people to know you were going to. It's hardly the place you just announce you're off to visit. It is a place where you perhaps go undercover or in darkness. But it is also a place where people would have talked about the goings-on in the city. Gossip central, if you like. A place where it would be good to find out what was going on. So does that mean it was a strategic part of the plan? And was there any thinking in the fact that Rahab's house is in the city wall that it had a good means of escape? We don't really know why they end up there, but that is where we find them, and that is also where the men of the land expect to find them. But we find the spies at the house of Rahab the prostitute. They go in, and Rahab immediately recognises them, and that they're not from the local area. She doesn't say how she knows, but she knows. In fact, I think I would like to claim that Rahab was a better spy than these two spies ever were. How do we know that she was a good spy? Well, first of all, she recognises the men. Then, before the local authorities turn up on their door, she's already hidden them. So she had advanced knowledge that they were coming. The people arrive at her door. She then deludes them that the men are even there. Spins some wild story that was so plausible that these chaps just jump off and leg it down the road going looking for them. Once this on the way, she goes up and has a further conversation with the spies. She then brokers a deal for protection with a secret signal known only to them and her. It's very good spying, isn't it? By the way, did anybody notice the echoes of a Passover lamb in the scarlet cord and the protection in the house? There's some really good kind of echoes of the previous stories coming through here. The red cord, a sign of protection, just like the blood of the lamb was the sign to God when he came over Egypt. Rahab then lets them out of the window. Now, either she's got muscles like the Hulk or she had a bit of help. She managed to do that without anybody spotting her. Again, brilliant ploy. And best of all, she then tells them how to not be caught, because they are clearly rubbish at this. So she tells them where to go and how long to wait. She is brilliant. I think she's a far better spy than the other two. In fact, she should be labelled Rahab the super spy, is what I decided, rather than Rahab the prostitute. But we need to note a couple of things about what Rahab said to the spies. Firstly, she tells them for 40 years, the people of the land have lived in fear. The people of Israel have been wandering the desert for 40 years, and for the same length of time, the people in the land of Jericho have been worried. Because the deeds of their God have, if you like, come before them. Stories that talked about the extraordinary power and authority of God. Stories that have been told and retold by people living in the land or travelling through. That they've known what this God of the Israelites has done. So for that 40 years, this people have been living on a knife edge, wondering when this group of people are going to kind of suddenly arrive in their land and take over. Wondering about this God that they've heard so much about, when he would send his people in. And the fact that the inhabitants of Jericho were melting in fear, that was vital information for the spies. So they finally managed to do something right. They finally managed to get some information, except they didn't even ask for it. They got told it. Still rubbish spies. But also what comes clear out of this is Rahab is a believer in God. Look what she says to the spies in verse 11. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. She acknowledges that the God of the Israelites is the God of heaven and earth. Let's get that straight. She's an inhabitant of Jericho and a member of an idolatrous pagan people. She is a prostitute living quite literally on the edge of society with the rest of the less well-off and more disreputable members of society. In a place where travellers and locals alike would frequent. She was an outcast because of her job, because her means of income was not probably of the highest regard. And yet she is well informed. Because the people who have come to her over the years have brought stories of the Israelites and of their God. And rumours now abound that the invasion is imminent. They know where the people of Israel are. They know they're the other side of the river. And she is living in the city wall itself. That must have made her feel pretty vulnerable. But that vulnerability brings her to a decision. Yes, she was afraid. But she made a decision not to give up the spies, because surely even harbouring them for a minute would have put her and her family's life in danger if she'd admitted that. She makes a decision for God. Of all the people in the city, she turns to God for her salvation. She has heard the tales of this God, the God of the Israelites, and has recognised something in them. The Israelites' God is the one true God. So she takes her living on the edge to a new level. And she goes against the beliefs of the city she's grown up in, the beliefs she has grown up with, but on what grounds? On the grounds of stories told by others. That's amazing that someone should come to faith through the stories of other people who are perhaps not even people of God. Stories heard on the sly, stories heard undercover in places where you wouldn't expect to hear about God. And these are stories that have been passed on because they are too good not to tell. Surely that should inspire us too, to be people who tell of the mighty deeds of God in our own lives and the lives of others. We should be people who go and tell in all times and in all places. Such that our stories of our God and his extraordinary power are retold and retold, so that others hear of how good he is, of the amazing thing that he's done for us. We might not think our stories are all that amazing, but God can use the events in our lives to draw others to him, just as he did for Rahab. For Rahab did not know a lot about God. Her faith was embryonic, based on the stories of others. But what she did know drove her to protect the spies. But that's where we find ourselves landing a little bit of controversy. Because to protect the spies, what did Rahab do? She lied by deliberately misinforming the king's men to save the lives of the spies. But was she justified? The chapter here simply records that there was a falsehood. It offers no comment. But it's clear from the Bible that lying is a sin. Exodus 20 verse 16, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbour. Leviticus 19:11, do not lie, do not deceive one another. Proverbs 12:22, the Lord detests lying lips, but he delights in people who are trustworthy. I guess we would say that lies that benefit ourselves rather than bringing honour to others are not right at all. Lies that give us an advantage or present ourselves as better than someone else or better than we actually are. Or lies that dishonour other people, they're all wrong. We'd agree with that? But what about surprise birthday parties? Or dummy plays in rugby? Or playing games like Perudo, a dice game that means liar's dice? Or how about playing two truths and a lie? Times when we deceive others intentionally, would we say that those kind of lies have a kind of neutrality about them? That while there is a deception, there is a way in which it's almost an honest and open one, that we're intending someone to be misled for a time, otherwise we'd ruin their unexpected surprise, or we're playing a game and ultimately the lie or lies will be revealed. And that's an understanding why that deception took place. But what about in the case for Rahab, the case of moral lies, that when an inaction or a blatant truth would result in a far worse moral outcome? The fact that Rahab lied has to be a problem. Because we know that in Hebrews 11, Rahab is praised for her faith in God. In James, he writes that Rahab was considered righteous for all that she did. And in Matthew chapter 1, Rahab is mentioned in the lineage of Jesus himself as the mother of Boaz, the one who married Ruth. But approval of Rahab in these areas, the fact that she has a place in Jesus' family tree, doesn't mean she had approval in every area of her life. She received recognition from biblical writers because she trusted in God, more the king of the Israelites, more than the king of Jericho. She had heard the stories of God, his power and authority, and demonstrated her faith in her actions by preserving the life of the spies. In the pressure of the moment, did she make a wrong choice? It's an interesting question, because some people say that God forgave Rahab for her lie because of her faith in him. Some have suggested she was simply deceiving the enemy, which was a normal practice in wartime. Some have even proposed that she wasn't even a Jew, so didn't fall under the law at the time, and is simply acting in accordance with her culture. In other words, she didn't know any better. While others offer the idea that Rahab broke a lesser principle, telling the truth, to uphold a greater principle, protecting God's people. I guess ultimately we have to say that Rahab's lies cannot be easily dismissed. Because in declaring that the spies had left and she didn't know which way they had gone was false. And we are told in Romans 3 verse 8 that we are not to do evil so that good may result. And it shouldn't be argued that this passage of the Bible validates deceit in circumstances. Truth is precious in God's sight. Even if Rahab's lies allow the spies to escape, we must be careful that we don't say that God is actually validating an act that goes against what the Bible says about truth and lies, that God does not like lying. We must not say that that's okay. And telling the truth for us is part of our covenantal responsibility as being part of the people of God. I mean, ultimately, it should be a responsibility for everybody. And we're not to decide on personal preference or use subjective reasoning to figure out when it's okay to lie or to not lie. There might have been a different way to save the spies. We have to trust that God will work his purposes out simply because he is God and infinitely able to do so. Did Rahab trust God? Maybe, maybe not. Either way, she made a choice. To her, with the faith that she had, the little knowledge that she had, she saw a solution and she took it. And perhaps if she'd known God better, known his power and what he was capable of, more than just the story she'd been told, then maybe she wouldn't have lied but trusted God to work his purposes out. Because the truth is that the better we know God, the more we know him, the more we spend time with him and develop our relationship with him, the more we develop our trust in him. And that can only be a good thing, because the more we trust him, the more we're able to believe that he will work his purposes out regardless of whatever situation we face. But we must never underestimate God's ability to use us, whether we've made what we consider to be the right decision or not. God can use us at our worst to bring about his purposes. And in this story, we see God using a deceitful woman of ill repute to ultimately bring forth his purposes. Almost every time she is referred to in the Bible, she is called Rahab the prostitute. We are aware of her sin. We know she lied. We know what her lifestyle was. Now, I heard this quote while I was cooking on Friday on Premier Praise. It was so striking, I had to turn the oven down and go and write it down, because I felt it was so good. And Andy even challenged me and said, all you need to do is stand up, say this and sit down. It would be a very short sermon. But this is what this chap said, and I don't even know who said it. I was so struck by what it was said. Satan knows us by name, but calls us by our sin. Jesus knows us by our sin, but calls us by our name. I'll say that again. Satan knows us by our name, but calls us by our sin. Jesus knows us by our sin, but calls us by our name. Rahab was more than she did wrong, just like we are more than things we do wrong. She was named in Hebrews as being a woman of faith. Why? Because she was more than her sins. And just like we are more than ours, because Jesus knows us. And he calls us by name because he loves us and he gave his life for us. And when Satan tries to remind us of our sin, remember who knows our name. It is engraved on the palms of his hands. Permanent. Because of what Rahab did, the spies returned to Joshua and gave him the affirmation of what God had said in the very first place of all. The promised land was there and God would give it into their hands. So in fact, we could almost bypass the whole of chapter 2 if only Joshua had believed what God had told him. Come to think of it, we could have bypassed the whole of the previous 40 years if they'd listened in the first place. But the truth is, they didn't listen. It wasn't the first time and it won't be the last. And I guess that could be said the same for us too. Do we listen to God? Do we look at our past experiences where God has proved faithful and remember that in the midst of whatever we're facing now? Or do we forget the mark of our faithful, the hand of our faithful God on our lives, allowing the enormity of our situations to mask our memories? It's all too easy to feel overwhelmed when we are faced with whatever giants are ahead of us or around us. But that is when we need to be reminded of God's faithfulness. And when those around us are struggling, can we be those reminders? Can we be the people who say to those who are struggling, our God is faithful? Because often it's very, very hard to say that ourselves when we are in the difficult place. The reality is, as we've seen from the lives of the Israelites, that our God is faithful, whether we believe it or not, whether we are or not. And God was and is and always will be infinitely bigger than any problem that we face. And his plans for us are better than anything we could ever imagine. We need to follow our with us always God wholeheartedly, with full commitment. We need to be people willing to witness about how he has worked in our lives, to share our stories wherever we can, whenever we can, and share the stories of others too. And we need to spend our time getting to know him better, because that develops our trust in him. And it will mean that we get better at recognising his presence with us and around us. Ultimately, God will work his purposes out in spite of our inadequacies. To quote the song that we sang just before the sermon, where there seems to be no way, you make it possible. Romans 8:28, and we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. All things. Not just isolated incidents. Not just once in a while. Not when he feels like it. But in all things. Even when we can't imagine that God could work through it. God will. It doesn't mean that everything that happens to us will be good, but it does mean that God will work through everything. As for the Israelites, ultimately we finish with them where we started. They are still on the brink of the promised land. They have not yet stepped forward and claimed God's promise. So I leave you on a cliffhanger. That moment in the programme when the things are just about to happen and the credits roll. So next time on Into the Promised Future, over the river. Tune in next week for the next exciting instalment.